right. Glad you're here tonight. Glad to be together to study the Word just a little bit. Lesson 20 in our study is where we are tonight. We're talking about young faces of faith, working our way through this study of a number of younger people anyway, probably younger, who are examples of faith, looking also at some counterexamples along the way. Today, we are looking at a couple of New Testament figures, so we're going to be spending most of our time in the Gospels and in Acts this evening. Our positive example tonight is who? Okay, we can't go any further until somebody says. John Mark. Okay, all right. John, whose surname was Mark. We're going to find out a little bit about him, talk about and very interesting developments in his life that we're going to talk about. And who's our counterexample tonight? All right. Let's talk about Judas Iscariot first. When you think about Judas, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Traitor. Universal. That's what everybody thinks of. And as a result of that, just to give an example, historically in movies that have been made about the life of Jesus and his interaction with the apostles, even without knowing which one he is, you can almost always pick Judas out because he's got this shifty look about him. You know, you look at him on the screen and you're thinking, something's not right about that guy. That's Judas. And sure enough, you know, he's just always looking sideways at everybody. You know, there's something about that. Just like in in the old Westerns, the bad guy always wore a black hat. That's how you could tell him apart from the good guy. Judas didn't wear a black hat. In fact, Matthew chapter 26, if you want to go ahead and be turning over there. Actually, our text for question number one is in Acts chapter 1 when they are selecting Judas's replacement. And Peter says he is to be taken from those who were with Jesus from the baptism of John until the day Jesus was taken up from us. Well, Judas obviously met that description, as did Peter and the rest of the 12. In Matthew chapter 26, when Matthew describes Judas going to the chief priests and saying, you know, what will you give me to hand him over to you? It just says in Matthew 26:14, then Judas, then one of the 12, named Judas Iscariot. Don't let that phrase just pass you by, because it's a reminder that Judas was one of the 12. And our first question asks us, you know, what kinds of faith-building things must Judas have witnessed during his time following Jesus? Sometimes we don't think about this, but we need to. So, you know, think about some of the things. Tell me some of the things that Judas would have witnessed and would have done as a man numbered among the 12. Chris?
Of course, there's many, many miracles, but the one that sticks out to me would be the calming of the storm and waves.
Okay, all right. Yeah, presumably he's on the boat that is in danger, seems to be in danger of sinking from this great storm, and Jesus calms the storm. How could you witness that and not be changed? All right? Take your pick of Jesus' miracles. Judas is likely a witness to a great many of them. Sometimes the Gospels don't give us details on which of the apostles may have been there. For example, picture the feeding of the 5,000. When the Gospels tell us that when that was over, remember, we start out with 5 loaves and a couple of fish, and Jesus miraculously multiplies that to feed this crowd of 5,000 was just the number of men, huge number of people. And when everyone had eaten, they took up the leftovers. There were 12 baskets full left over. That's a nice comparable number to make us think of Judas carrying one of those baskets of leftover food from the feeding of the 5,000. You know, being in that sense a firsthand witness of what happened. Okay? Other things come to mind? All right? Yeah, the raising of Lazarus. In John's narrative, John kind of builds his narrative around seven particular signs that Jesus performs, miracles, and the raising of Lazarus is sort of, in some ways, the culmination of that. The resurrection is really the culmination of that, but the raising of Lazarus, Judas presumably present for that, witnesses this, and this is not the only time Jesus raised somebody from the dead. It's just the one that John focuses on. What else? Okay, so he sees a lot of miracles. What else does Judas experience in his time with Jesus that should have been faith building? I hear the word. Okay, yeah. Christ's teaching. So many of these recorded sermons in Matthew and Mark and Luke and John, Judas is there listening to those things. Just like the rest of Jesus' disciples are. Again, take your pick of the miraculous signs, and Judas surely witnessed many of them. Take your pick of the things Jesus teaches, the particular occasions of teaching, let's put it that way, in the Gospels, and Judas is probably there. Barry?
Well, when they were sent out by Jesus, were they given powers themselves?
Yes, okay. Look at Luke chapter 9. I was hoping somebody would bring that one up. Can I get somebody to read this? Luke chapter 9, verses 1 through 6. Just pay attention who is being sent out and what they are being sent out to do, what they do in this. Luke 9, verses 1 through 6. Who's got that? David, go ahead.
Sent them out to proclaim the kingdom of God and to heal. And he said to them, take nothing for your journey, no staff, nor bag, nor bread, nor money. Do not have two tunics. Whatever house you enter, stay there, and from there depart. And wherever they do not receive you, when you leave that town, shake off the dust from your feet as a testimony against them. And they departed and went through the villages, preaching the gospel.
All right. So what does verse 1 say Jesus gives them the power to do? Or gives them power and authority over? All right. Yeah. Gives them power to cast out demons, to heal diseases. What does he send them out to do? Verse 2. Okay. Yeah. To preach, to proclaim the kingdom of God and to perform healing. And verse 6 says that's exactly what they did. Okay, so Judas is doing this right along with the other 11. He is sent on this, sometimes call it the limited commission. He goes, he preaches about the kingdom. He is calling on people to accept the kingdom, to allow the rule of God in their hearts. And he's working miracles. He didn't just see them. He was empowered to perform them. Anything else come to mind that should have been a real faith builder? Shane.
Well, I mean, this one's not as random as an example as a song, but I can't help but think of when Jesus was
right.
He said this could have been sold and given to the poor in an auspice of a good deed, but he wanted there to be money for him to go out of the money bags. So
right.
You see where his motivations lie in that scripture.
Right. Yeah. One of the interesting things about that is when you read the parallels, all the disciples were critical of this woman's actions. It's just that Judas seems to have had a different motivation for his criticism than the other 11. But yeah, okay. Think about John chapter 13. Oh, Doug, go ahead. Yeah.
I'm going to add another thing.
Yeah.
Would impress, I think, anybody is being with Jesus for 3 years, in and out, all circumstances, he didn't stand.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you think he would take notice of that after a while? Okay. You know, that he never got morally, spiritually tripped up. Was always, as we sometimes like to say, he was always master of the situation. And when people would come to him with sometimes disingenuous questions trying to entrap him, he always gave exactly the right response. That had to make an impression on the disciples as they witnessed these things. I thought about John chapter 13 when at the Last Supper, Jesus washes the feet of the disciples. Because based on the way the narrative reads in John 13, Judas was still there. He was still in the room when Jesus did that. So he got his feet washed too. That says a great deal, by the way. You know, Jesus, knowing what Judas was going to do, washed his feet anyway. But all these, you know, all these things he experiences, sees, hears, and does right alongside the other 11. Anything else real big come to mind? Anthony?
Well, just the fact that Jesus tells him 2 days, you're going to betray me after all this time that he's trying to do it behind Jesus' back. I know that's miraculous as well, but just even more personal.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. Okay, very good. We're going to talk about that in a minute. All right. And we read that and we think about that and say, I would like to think that if I witnessed and did all of those things, I'd be a rock. My faith would just be as solid as it was possible to be. These are the things that Judas encountered and did in his time with Jesus. Let's look at John chapter 13. We could find this in the parallels in Matthew as well. We'll mention Matthew and Mark and Luke as well. But Jesus predicts both Judas's betrayal of him and Peter's denial of him. Those things end up going very different. When Jesus predicts Judas's betrayal, says, you know, that it's the one who dips his hand in the sop with me, that's the one who's going to betray me, and everybody's, you know, asking about this. And in Matthew's account in chapter 26, you know, Judas says, surely it is not I, Lord. Okay. Now all the rest of the disciples are kind of saying the same thing, but, you know, surely it's not me. And Jesus, according to John's account in John 13, says to him, what you do, do quickly. And Judas gets up and leaves. Now, the rest of the disciples don't know why he's left. They assume he's going to get provisions or something, but you know, what you do, do quickly. Is that the way you would hope you would react if Jesus was saying, you know, was identifying you as the one who betrayed him? Oh, surely it's not me. And Jesus says, oh, you better get to it. Okay. And, you know, goes, I don't know, you know exactly what Judas's attitude or disposition was, and, you know, what it looked like. And then, let's contrast Peter for a minute. When Peter, you know, says, you will all be made to stumble because, or when Jesus says, you will all be made to stumble because of me this night, is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. And they're all, no, Peter especially, no, I'm ready, whatever comes. And Jesus tells him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. And Peter, in response to that, says, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And Peter really, at that moment, believed that. He was convinced of the truth of that. When Judas is confronted with the guilt of what he has done, what is his reaction? Yeah. I mean, Matthew 27 says, you know, when he saw that Jesus was condemned, he went back to the chief priests and said, you know, I've sinned by betraying innocent blood, and they're just totally apathetic. Don't care. And so he casts down the money in their presence in the temple, and he goes out and ends it all. Right? Okay. Joey, go ahead. You may be allowed. Go ahead.
I don't think Judas doubted Jesus' power at all. In fact, I think Judas betrayed Jesus because he thought Jesus would get away, just like he had many other times. He's witnessed all these things. He knows Jesus has the power to slip through the hands of these people. I don't think he expected Jesus to let them take him. Jesus got away just like he had all these other times. Judas has 30 pieces of silver.
And still
and
has
Jesus is still fine. Mm-hmm. And he's good to go. So I don't think Judas doubted Jesus in that sense.
Right.
And the irony is that it's Peter who doubted Jesus. But after the fact, Peter became strong in faith and Judas became weak. Peter knew that Jesus would forgive him. Judas thought Jesus maybe couldn't forgive him. Mm-hmm. And he had to pay for his own sins. So there's some irony, I think, between these two.
I think there is. And I think that's exactly the contrast we really want to make between these two. Is Peter's denial of Jesus really any less, you know, somehow less sinful than Judas's betrayal of Jesus? And could the situations very well, you know, to Doy's point, remember, Peter's the one when Jesus was starting to talk about going down to Jerusalem and being given over to the Jewish leaders and killed. Peter's the one that said, no, this will never happen to you, Lord. And Jesus has, you know, had to correct him. You're thinking in the wrong direction. You've got your mind on the things of man rather than the things of God. So, you know, that's right. Jesus said to Peter in Luke chapter 22, Simon, Satan has demanded permission to sift you, and the you is plural, sift all of you as wheat, but I have, Simon, prayed for you so that your faith may not fail, and when you are, once you have turned again, or when you are restored, strengthen your brothers. There's a glimmer of hope there. And I think Doy spoke to that. What is when the rooster crows after Peter has denied Jesus three times? What does Peter do? Yeah, it says he went out and wept bitterly. Not he went out and hanged himself. He still had, you know, very deep regret. But you see with Peter, the kind of hope for forgiveness and reconciliation that is not present with Judas. And also, you know, more than one commentator has observed how different everything would have been if Judas had just waited 3 days. But different reactions. Now, part of the reason we're talking about that is to set up the contrast with John Mark. We're going to be talking, who also falls prey to weakness. Talk about him in a minute. Other thoughts about Judas in particular, or Judas in contrast with Peter? Yeah, Doy's right that the Bible doesn't tell us all the things that were going on in Judas's thinking. I think his supposition is a reasonable one. That's certainly a possibility as to what Judas was thinking. There really wasn't going to be any significant consequence to what he did, and when there was, He was overwhelmed with the guilt of it. Let's talk about John Mark. And the occasion we need to look at, first of all, is in Acts chapter 13. So turn to Acts 13. We have to put two passages together to get the whole picture. Acts 13 is Paul's first missionary journey. Paul, Barnabas, John Mark goes along with them. Verse 13 says, Now Paul and his companions put out to sea from Paphos and came to Perga in Pamphylia. But John, that's John Mark, what did John do? Verse 13. He left them and returned to Jerusalem. That's all Acts 13 tells us. Doesn't say why. Doesn't say what he was thinking, what was going on. You know, whether it just says he left them and went back to Jerusalem. Now we'll go to chapter 15. End of chapter 15, starting in verse 36. We see the plans being made for Paul's second missionary journey. After some days, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let us return and visit the brethren," verse 36, "visit the brethren in every city in which we proclaim the word of the Lord," excuse me, "and see how they are." Barnabas, wanted to take John called Mark along with them also. He went with us before. Barnabas wants to take him again. Now we find something out, verse 38. But Paul kept insisting that they should not take him along who had deserted them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. Now, it still doesn't tell us a great deal, but Luke uses the word deserted to describe what John Mark did, or at the very least, he uses it to describe Paul's evaluation of what John Mark did. And it suggests standing aloof, withdrawing oneself, but it can also mean to fall away or to become faithless. Why Mark left is unclear, but what does this suggest when you put these two passages together? What does this suggest about John Mark? What does it suggest about his faith?
Not as strong as it needed to be.
Okay. Okay. Can you understand the reasons why he might turn back? You know, no indication that he got sick or anything like that. Wayne?
He remembered he had an appointment back home, and he forgot about it, and he didn't want to stand people up and look bad. I don't know. It's a very strange thing when we read about this, and wouldn't it have been nice if Luke, as he's writing, would have given a little bit of information there, maybe his assessment while Mark had left, but he doesn't.
How often do I find myself saying that? Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you've been around them, whatever, they don't get some good reception in some of the cities that they do, so I don't know if that weighs on him to, maybe this isn't something I'm going to cut out for.
All right. Yep. So Paul's assessment is John Mark doesn't need to go with us. He abandoned us last time. He's not up to the, at the very least, he is not up to the, his faith is not strong enough. He is not committed enough for this. Barnabas is very desirous of taking John Mark along, so much so, what does verse 39 tell us? Okay. Luke writes, "There occurred such a sharp disagreement that they separated from one another. Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus. Paul chose Silas and left, being committed by the brethren to the grace of the Lord, and was traveling through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches." We don't necessarily need to read any animosity or ill will into this. They disagreed over what I would call a matter of judgment about John. It's been about 3 years since John Mark turned back and went to Jerusalem. And some 3 years later, we're preparing for another journey. Can you see Paul's thinking? Can you understand why Paul would be reluctant to take him along? Okay. We needed him and he left us. Yeah. Do it.
How many people can Paul trust? You think about Paul's life. To go on a journey with Paul means you're putting your life in danger every day. And he's got to trust the people that he's with. Demas forsook him, having loved this present world. And I imagine it's probably the same kind of thing there. It's not that Demas was necessarily a horribly worldly person as much as can't put my life on the line.
Right.
Again, we don't know how told specifically, but given Paul's track record for being stoned and shipwrecked and everything else, to be his travel companion, you got to be cut from a different cloth.
Okay, yeah. Can you see Barnabas's point? We understand why Paul wouldn't want to take him along. Can we understand why Barnabas would? Wayne?
You know, there's so much supposition going on. If we're not careful, we will find ourselves, I think, perhaps being too critical, Mark. Mm-hmm. I find it difficult, but did Barnabas have some insight? Did they talk with, had he talked with John Mark? And John Mark, he told me, listen, I had a legitimate reason. I don't know that. I'm just guessing too. But Paul felt it was it was an unforgivable thing that he did to them and left them that way. Perhaps he could have said shorthanded or whatever it was. We didn't have him to back us up. And there's no way I'd take another chance on him there. Can't fault Paul with the way he thought. But Barnabas, we could say, well, now listen, Barnabas has always been an exhorter. He has always been one that you could say, well, he's the encourager, and he's trying to encourage John Mark now. Mm-hmm. Let him know that, okay, you really didn't do right there, but I want to take you back with us, and I feel confident you're not going to do that again. But there it is. It's guesswork.
Yeah.
Well, you have the extra factor that he's also family to Barnabas as well.
Right. Yeah. Colossians 4 tells us they were cousins. So, yeah, that may, hard not to think that entered into it a little bit. Right. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah. And remember, Barnabas is the guy who went to bat for Paul before the rest of the apostles. When Saul first came to Jerusalem, and the other disciples didn't want anything to do with him because this guy's a notorious persecutor of the church. Barnabas is the one who vouched for him. That's just the way, that's the pattern of his character, at least so insofar as it's revealed in the New Testament. Yeah, we don't want to speculate too much because there's a lot that we don't know. The point is, you can see Paul's point, and you can see Barnabas's point about this. John Mark fell short. That doesn't necessarily mean he totally abandoned his faith in God, but he left Paul and Barnabas in the lurch. And to Paul, that means he's not ready to go on this journey. Now, here's the question, because this really isn't about Paul or Barnabas. We're thinking about John Mark tonight. Question number 5. Try for a minute to put yourself in John Mark's position, even though there's a lot we don't know about all the ins and outs of this. How could he have dealt with having disappointed Barnabas and Paul? Especially when Paul says, nope, I don't want John Mark to go with us because of what happened last time. Wayne, go ahead.
Say that it's easy for me to say because I'm not John Mark, but I could say, well, now, then to Barnabas. Barnabas, I don't want there to be some kind of rift between you and Paul, and I'd really rather or better just stay behind so that there won't be. I I don't know that there's any, could you find any place where there was a falling out, if we could call it, between Barnabas and Paul over this?
Not what I'd call a division of their sense of fellowship with one another, no. If John Mark is presumably fairly young when all this happens, could this have been a big discouragement to him? I messed up so bad Paul doesn't even want me to go along this time. Here I am, I think I'm ready to go. Barnabas thinks I'm ready to go, and Paul says no. What could that do to a person if he allowed it to?
Away, but did Mark ever apologize to Paul or to Barnabas?
I don't know. It is, as I was thinking about this, I thought, you know, John Mark could have chosen the Judas option or the Peter option. I don't think John Mark would have necessarily committed suicide over this. But he could have chosen the Judas option of saying, I give up. I can't do this. I've let everybody down. And just thrown it all away. People do that. And most all of us at some point have known someone who did that, who was a Christian, and there was some failure in their life. It may not have even, not that we can rank those failures big or small, but it may not have even seemed to be all that big. But it was to them. And the fallout from it was to them. And the level of discouragement it created for them was such that they just, at some point, not necessarily right away, but at some point, you know what, I failed. I've let God down. I've let my brothers and sisters down. I give up. Or he could choose the Peter option. I failed, and I feel terrible about it. Now what? And Peter, I don't think it's without some prompting from Jesus on Peter's part to really get him back on his feet, but he does. Makes himself useful. Now, what the end result of this is that two evangelistic teams go out and twice as much evangelizing gets done. Paul takes Silas, Barnabas takes Mark, and lots of things get done. And there's more to this story that we're going to get to in just a minute. Because if this was all there was, we'd think, okay, well, Mark is still kind of a weakling. Barnabas is really being kind. He's being Barnabas, and he's giving him a second chance, and that's great. Maybe he's trying to encourage him. But has he redeemed himself in Paul's eyes yet? Has he really? Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. But just from what you know, does John Mark end up doing? So it would seem, yeah. Yeah. If you've got that open, would you read that for us? 2 Timothy chapter 4. Didn't mean to put you on the spot. I'll give you a second to open up to it. Yeah. And while Dave's turning there, and if you're turning there, remember this is Paul writing to Timothy when Paul's in prison in Rome. This is probably his last written words. And he's given Timothy some instructions. I'd like you to do this. I'd like you to bring this. Now, go ahead. Chapter 4, verse 11.
And though I Luke is with me, get Mark and bring him with you because he is helpful to me in my ministry.
Okay. What does that tell you?
He's helpful to
me. Okay. Well, it tells us he's helpful to Paul's ministry. We don't know exactly what has transpired in those intervening years. But Paul, it really seems that Paul's evaluation of Mark has changed. In question number 6, we've also got references to 1 Peter chapter, to Colossians 4, to Philemon. Paul mentions Mark in both of those, and mentions him as if he is somebody that Paul thinks well of. Doy?
Mm-hmm. So
when Demas has forsaken him and all deserted me at my first defense. It's pretty significant.
Yes, it is. It's an important contrast. And I think, I don't think it's this, I don't remember, I don't think he uses exactly the same word of Demas' desertion that Luke does of Mark's, but that's, you know, that would be probably splitting hairs. But, you know.
Well, it's not the same word, but yeah. It's, Paul's obviously sensitive right. About those who deserve.
Yeah. It'd be kind of hard not to be in Paul's situation, right? But here he's got a lot of confidence in Mark, so much so that he asks Timothy, you be sure you bring him with you. In 1 Peter chapter 5, now we're not reading Paul's words, we're reading Peter's words, and who do we find with Peter at the end of 1 Peter chapter 5? Verse 13. I thought somebody would just be able to guess this even without turning over there. Okay, all right. Okay. I guess it's hard to be 100% certain, but the general consensus is that that's who Peter is describing, and he's using son very much in the same sense that Paul does with regard to somebody like Timothy. He's my son in the faith. If that is the case, if this is indeed the same John Mark, then he has not only proven himself useful to Paul, he's developed a useful relationship with Peter as well. And again, what I'd call the most prevalent view, at least among conservative biblical scholars, is that this is the guy who ends up writing one of the four Gospels. And there are ancient Christian writers who their assertion was that he got a lot of his information from Peter when he was with him. The point being, this is a person who, when we encounter him in Acts 13, and we learn a little bit more about it in Acts 15, it doesn't look so good. He's shown to some degree, in some way, a weakness in faith. Not a total abandonment of faith, but it's a weakness. It's a weakness that Paul thinks is a very serious problem. And yet, later on, as the years go by, this is somebody who develops into someone very useful in the kingdom. Very useful to Paul personally, to Peter, and by extension to all of us. We put all that together. What does that suggest, without asking you to do much, too much speculating? What does that suggest about the way John Mark dealt with the failure in his life?
He didn't let it get him down.
Okay, all right. He didn't take the Judas option. All right. He didn't take the Judas option of, well, if I can't do any better than that, then I give up. Okay. I've let people down, or I can't do this whole Christianity thing. It's too hard. Heard people say that. All right. He, very much like Peter did, accepted the grace of God as it was offered to him, and he rebuilt. He went on. He accomplished good. Now, what does that have to teach us?
We make mistakes, and we need to get up and go on and ask for forgiveness.
Okay. All right. Yeah, okay. Other thoughts? Got just a minute or two. David?
It seems that Judas tries to fix the situation himself, where Peter, John Mark, rely on other Christians, Barnabas, Peter, have a true remorse. But it just seems that Judas tried to fix everything himself, and I think maybe we can dig ourselves in a hole, and then we try to fix it.
Right. Okay. Very good point. Again, without having a psychological profile of Judas's state of mind when he took his own life, You know, you're probably looking at somebody who has decided what I have done is beyond forgiveness, and rendered my life beyond hope. Peter was brought to depths of grief, but not to that conclusion. John Mark, probably, at a certain point felt terrible about what had happened, but he didn't let it drive him there. And Wayne's point earlier was very important. Some of the rest of you have echoed that. That's a vital lesson for us, and we're learning this from people who were, from John Mark, who evidently was relatively young. When he was given another opportunity, he saw that as God's grace being extended to him, and he took it. Accomplished a lot of useful things in the kingdom as a result. It sounds trite, and it sounds bubblegum psychology almost, but Christians don't have to let our mistakes define us. We don't have to be defined by our sin. In fact, I think Doy talked about that a little bit on a Sunday morning not too long ago. We're not defined by our sin. We're defined by the grace that God offers us and our response to that. And that's one of the differences that we have here. Shane, go ahead.
That in these people who learned from their mistakes, they became better people and became better servants of God because they didn't put a permanent end to their lives.
Right. Very good point. I hope we haven't speculated too much tonight, because there's a lot about all of these things that, as far as the details, we're not really told. David, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So they're implying that basically at this point, maybe he didn't have that much control over himself, mm-hmm. and Satan's really controlled him to the point that, you're just done. You're not going to overtake you, because this is all the plan that you think, but it says that Satan entered.
Right. Question is, how did Judas get to the point where Satan could do that? That makes me think of a passage like Romans 1, where Paul's really talking about it on a cultural level, but probably can happen with an individual. We resist God's plan so long or to such an extent that God gives us over to that resistance. Lesson 21 on Sunday, we'll look at some more examples of young people of faith. Got some more Old Testament characters coming up. As we kind of wind this down, got two more weeks in this study, and then we'll be starting a new study in the first Sunday in September. I'll tell you more about that next time. In fact, we're going to be, we'll talk about that next time a little bit. Thanks for all your comments and questions tonight. Appreciate it very much.